Welcome, everybody. This is your prerequisite session for Channel Masters kickoff. We're going to talk about two things today. Just to be sure that everybody has a common base of understanding and terminology, before we get in the room, we're going to look at partner business models, and then we're also going to take a look at how partners make money, so partner financials. For those of you I haven't met, my name is Raleen Oakes. I'll be one of your co-hosts when we get into the room together for the kickoff. I'm a former channel chief, started out at IBM where I was a software channel chief, BEA, and Oracle. So I've had an opportunity oftentimes to sit in your seats, and it's my absolute pleasure to be on this side of the table as well. Look forward to spending not only our kickoff time, but a few minutes with you here today. So in order to get started on the topic of business models, what I'd like to do is draw your attention to the pie chart on the left side of this slide. And when you take a look at this pie chart, we're going to take a look at it from a couple of different angles. The first angle is around traditional business models, and what you see here are traditional business models highlighted, things like VAR, consultant, systems integrator. We're also going to take a look at two business models that change this pie when you take a look at cloud and some new capabilities that came to light with cloud. And then lastly, we're going to spend a fair amount of time around how these partners make money, what's different about how they make money. So that said, let's go ahead and get started straight on traditional business models. The pie on the left-hand side, pie chart, represents research that we've done here in the U.S., roughly against a population of about 160,000, 170,000 solution providers in the U.S. These are folks who are in our database, also part of the CRM leadership, and it's where we spend a lot of time understanding how partners think, how they make money, what they're likely to do. What you start to see over time, if we looked at this historically, you would start to see the VAR piece of this pie, roughly 28%, has decreased over time as VARs have left the pure play model and picked up either managed services or systems integration capability over time to keep up with the complexity of system solutions that are being brought to market by vendors like yourself. If you take a look at the MSP hoster segment, when we started tracking this, I want to say maybe 5, 6, 8 years ago, that was about 8% of the pie, and that has continued to grow very steadily today, sitting at 23% or more of the pie. And remember, we'll talk a little bit later about a managed service provider. They're not necessarily just a hoster looking at server storage and systems management software. They could be managing anything from print to networks, whatever the case may be. And for those of you joining us from the telephony side of the house, you'll see carrier agents up at the top, around 2% of the pie. We have actually seen this piece grow over the last 5 years. It was 1% of the pie and, you know, small number, but it's doubled. This truly reflects the number of VARs, integrators, and other partners who truly picked up voice, data, and internet to make an end-to-end solution around cloud so that they had the underlying telephony-type capabilities added to the IT capabilities, okay? So that's just a very high level. And what I really wanted to do at this point was to walk you through not necessarily all the words, but to help you understand how it is partners fall into these labels of business models. The number one thing I'd like to tell you is that we don't assign labels to partners. We also, number two, don't ask partners whether they're a VAR or a consultant or an ISV. What we ask the partners is, how do you recognize your revenue? Tell us how you're recognizing revenue. And based on how they recognize revenue, then that indicates one of these buckets, and the buckets are mutually exclusive, right? So typically we can only find one as their primary business model. So let's look at a couple of examples of that. What you start to see here for a solution provider, if a solution provider or a heritage VAR, if greater than 50% of their company's revenues come from selling hardware, software, services with some integration, and they tend to resell to an end user, meaning they take title to the product and then resell it to the customer, then they would find themselves self-declaring into the VAR bucket. So greater than 50% of their revenues. Let's compare and contrast that, let's say, to consultants. You notice a consultant's revenues, greater than 90% of their company's revenues come from pre-sales design, planning, consulting, and it could be business consulting as well as IT consulting. They tend not to take title to the product meeting, they might write a bill of materials and say, go to CDW and go get this hardware software. We'll provide the services and expand on our pre-sale services, and then we'll do the post-sale services as well. So that's how a consultant would be different from a VAR slash solution provider. And again, the way we tell is not by asking them, but by looking at their revenue. And when they have 100% of their revenues come from consulting, we know they're not a reseller. Best examples that you would see recently would be the born in the cloud type partners that are part of the Salesforce.com, sometimes Google, sometimes Amazon Web Services ecosystem, but especially Salesforce.com, because their partner program does not allow resell. Most of their partners are in fact consultants. Some of them are systems integrators because they might put other products besides Salesforce in a consulting engagement. Okay? So number two, let's look at another one, ISV. In this case, 85% of a company's revenues or more come from, a proprietary, commercially available application package that is sold to customers. And it can run on Windows, it could be a Mac operating system, it could be even a mobile type application. But typically they are developing this proprietary application and it's commercially available to end customers. And we'll talk about why commercially available to end customers is important when we get to the straight developer model a little bit later. Okay? Let's take a look at three more. We talked about CDW a little bit earlier. CDW would be an example of a direct marketing reseller where typically 90 to 100% of their revenues, whether it's CDW, SHI, even the call center at Dell. Dell traditionally has been a very large direct marketer, DMR. But basically, most of the company's revenues come from reselling product, and less than 10% of their revenues come from services. And we say that because if you take a look at CDW's financials, and as much as CDW has built services capabilities and teams with other partners to deliver services, still their revenue comes largely from reselling product. So that's a direct marketing reseller. And if you ever find a VAR who provides almost no services at all, and they truly are a reseller, meaning 90 to 100% of their revenues come from services, they're unfortunately likely competing with a DMR, which is very difficult to do because these tend to be very large companies, whether it's Zones or SHI or CDW or Dell. I mean, they're large companies with large economies of scale. And because they buy a lot, they get great discount leverage when they're negotiating with vendors. And a standalone VAR would definitely be at a disadvantage trying to compete there, which is why most VARs have moved towards consulting services, systems integration, managed services, something to add to their reselling capability. And that brings us to the systems integrator, where something like 70% of their revenues come from consulting and design services, and hopefully in the pre-sales perspective. And then 30%, or could be 40%, anything, come from reselling product. It could be hardware and software. And the reason they put the consulting, the hardware, and the software together is because it takes the hardware, software, and the services to put a total end-to-end solution, and they tend to be a single point of a solution provider. Sometimes they could even be a sole source, and they'll come in and they'll do the whole thing, hardware, software, services. So again, what differentiates a systems integrator from a consultant is that a consultant is 90 to 100% consulting. They tend not to take title to and resell product, and a systems integrator will, in fact, resell product. Okay? Let's take a look at a custom systems builder. These folks have been around for a long time, and you've also heard of them as maybe white box or custom systems guys. They tend to buy the components from, let's say, Ingram, and they'll put the components together and really, and what I want to say, design and build a specialized box. The specialty could be for healthcare. It could be for gaming. It could be for a commercial application. It could be for a public sector application. But there's a reason why they are optimizing the machine in terms of how it's built to actually support a type of application or a particular use. And so 50% or more of their company's revenues come from this concept of custom building boxes, actual hardware, okay? Let's go forward to three more. Managed service provider. In this particular case, a company's revenue of 50% or more comes from delivering IT in a recurring revenue contract, monthly recurring revenue, MRR, with a service level agreement, then they tend to be a managed service provider. The thing to remember is that a managed service provider is just not a data center provider. They could provide managed server storage software. It could also be networking. It could be managed print. It could be managed desktop. It could be managed communications. It could be managed just, it could be managed IT. We have people who are so broad as to say, we'll just take over your whole IT. Managed IT, they charge so many dollars per head per month, and that's how they go. So 50% or more of their revenues, if 50% or more of their revenues are still reselling, even though they have managed services, they fall into the VAR bucket. If 51% of their revenues are from managed services and they resell, they fall into the MSP bucket. So you can see that the, how they recognize revenues truly becomes an indicator, because those two models look very much alike, reselling plus MSP when you put them together. It's just a function of which is the primary revenue source. That's the bucket they fall into. So now the next question you might ask is, well, how is that different from a hosting services provider? A hosting services provider would be someone like, let's say, a Rackspace. And there's a whole bunch of these, and you would look at them as infrastructure as a service provider. And we'll go through the history of infrastructure as a service provider a little bit later. But if you're a hosting services provider, 85% or more of your revenues come from shared, dedicated, or virtual private servers. So you really do, in fact, have a data center, and you're using it for, it's been virtualized, you're using it for cloud, colo, you could be hosting any type of application, but you truly are a data center services provider versus a managed service provider, which could be providing any type of managed service. And then we'll start to get ready to close out here on the model known as app developer. And if you look at the pie chart, you will have seen it there as web developer. And in our previous models, we would have been web developer. But as time moves on, this truly is, in fact, an app developer. And here, company revenues primarily come from development of applications. So they have specialists with capabilities like DevOps. They might be developing traditionally software as a service applications, could be mobile applications. And the, what differentiates an app developer from an ISV is that an app developer may not have a commercially available application that is being sold software as a service or on-prem. They traditionally would be developing custom apps for a customer, although they may have developed an app, they may take it to a software as a service marketplace, and they may consider themselves at that point a commercially available software developer. And then they would fall into the ISV bucket. So really the deal here is once they start selling to the masses, meaning commercially available, either because they had the heritage of doing so like a Microsoft or an Oracle or Cerner and McKesson to hospital packages, once they start selling through marketplaces, even if they don't have that size behind them, they would typically be considered an ISV rather than an application developer. Think of an application developer as somebody who's not necessarily out there selling commercially available. They're doing custom work. Okay. Now, in addition to all of that, I mentioned that we had service provider agents. The history or the heritage here are the carrier service providers, so telcos, cable cos, and others. Their channel was traditionally a little bit different than the IT channel. It was very much more recommendation with post-sale commissions, where the IT channel was resell by taking title to a product at a discount and keeping the difference between what they sold it for and the discount, which we call margin. A service provider agent absolutely came from those days of internet, voice, long distance, all of the services that put together and powered cloud and the internet. But we'll talk a little bit later about how truly the carrier service providers have become the aggregators of cloud solutions. And so this channel has very much grown. With a heritage around telephony today, they can sell small business, medium business, even enterprises with truly aggregated cloud solutions. And we would say here that your company's revenue predominantly comes from carrier-based high-speed you know, data access, cable, online, all of those things. Okay. A distributor. Most of us know distributors, Ingram, Marisol, or Ingram Tech Data, Synnex, Avnet, Arrow. A distributor resells products to the downstream solution providers. They could sell to resellers, VARs, integrators, whoever is actually looking for product. And they all typically recruit partners. They'll put training. They'll do demand gen programs. The big differentiator here, a distributor is not licensed typically to sell to an end customer. They sell to another business that then sells to the end customer. Okay? So that's the definition that we use in our research across all the business models in the red piece of the pie. And then we also put a couple in there that you don't see, like distributor. And we tend to pull distributors out when we do our research because we're truly looking at customer-facing partners. Let's take a look now at two additional models, cloud business models. And what you start to see here are a couple of just quotes about, you know, how important the concept of building recurring revenue. Most important thing, right, you see in terms of the future investment in any technology area is building recurring revenue. So that takes us back to cloud and sometimes managed services. And I want to mention that there are two specific cloud business models. On the left-hand side, you see the cloud aggregator or the cloud marketplace. We touched on this a little bit earlier. An aggregator is one who aggregates or pulls together a couple of public, maybe it could be one public cloud service, and they'll put it together with training, intellectual property, some other type solution to put together a horizontal solution like Office 365 or Google, or a vertical solution like doctor's offices, healthcare, whatever the case might be. They put these solutions together based on the public cloud service so that resellers and agents can pull these aggregated solutions out of the distributor and take them to market in the way they always have done resold technology. The number one thing we've seen over years has been backup disaster recovery. That tends to be probably the number one aggregated cloud solution that's available for partners to take to market. The number two would be Office 365 or Google, meaning, you know, the whole Office kind of suite. And if you take a look behind that, you'd see things like VoIP and other type voice capabilities. And if you take a look at backup disaster recovery, voice, and Office, that's what kind of you need to open the doors for business if you're a small or medium-sized business. So it's probably no surprise that those show up at the top. So you see folks here, Ingram Tech Data, Arrow, CenturyLink, AT&T, all of these folks over the years where we traditionally just had distributors, you saw these marketplaces like AppDirect and SaaS Max show up as marketplaces where people could sell aggregated cloud solutions. And then you saw the recent entries of the telcos and cable cos start to bring aggregated cloud solutions here built on their internet capability, long distance service, and other things truly integrated as end-to-end solutions. So that's yet another business model definition, this concept of a cloud aggregator, or specifically in AppDirect or SaaS Max's example, a cloud marketplace. And that brings us to a really interesting role, this cloud broker. The role of the cloud broker is someone who provisions public cloud services, they're managing public cloud services, and they likely audit and help a customer maintain compliance around these public cloud services. And typically our research has shown that, you know, when a customer gets to three or more public cloud services, they really do appreciate the services of a cloud broker to come in and manage that for them so they don't have to. And if we go back to the earliest days of Salesforce.com and you look at people who started like Cloud Sherpas managing the acquisition of these public cloud license capabilities and then building intellectual property around the Salesforce.com solution, you start to see companies who started out as cloud brokers and built themselves into very true consulting systems integrators, app developers, and ISV firms from the very early days of how do I manage these public cloud services. So we would tell you that they're out there today, and those would be the two additional roles. What we would tell you to watch for, if you look at the top of this chart, is just like we've seen new players come into the marketplace for cloud, watch for new solution aggregators with the growth of Internet of Things, IoT, and we'll talk about that when we get together as a group for the kickoff. Now, I mentioned before that, you know, if you look at a whole solution, it typically includes hardware, software, and some type of a public cloud service somewhere if you look at a customer's environment. And today, those tend to be the three main types of vendors we have: hardware manufacturers, software publishers, and service providers. So just to put that on there, and again, I would tell you, watch this space, because what we you'll now see when we get to the kickoff is add operational technology vendors, people like Siemens, Schneider Electric, Cree, and others who will come into our ecosystem because they're recruiting our partners as Internet of Things truly uses IT and the cloud to connect everything out there. Now, that kind of finishes up our conversation around business models. I mentioned to you that we do a look back in terms of service providers, because the service provider, we use one category of service provider, but it's really a very rich and very rich space in terms of who the players are. So we're big believers in segmentation. This, we're going to start looking at service providers from a segmented point of view, and the first we're going to look at are the application service providers. These are the software as a service providers. You know, so you get traditional on-prem apps like SAP, Microsoft, Oracle, Google not being traditional, Google being only a cloud-based application, SaaS, but all of the big traditionals have moved to SaaS. You then, I mentioned things like take any vertical like healthcare and hospitals. So Cerner and McKesson are two of the biggest hospital packages in the U.S. Those used to be on-prem. They are now available as a service. And then the original Salesforce.com, the original entry to cloud, the first application as a service available. So you could keep adding that application as a service provider bucket is huge, in as much as there are very few applications that are developed today that go on-prem. They either are mobile or they're software as a service sitting in the cloud. So that's bucket number one. Bucket number two tends to be platform as a service providers. And if you think back in the day, we used to have corporate application developers or even ISV application developers, and they had dev machines, development machines. These machines were used during the day. They sat idle at night, and therefore they were underutilized. And so the whole concept of cloud gave us the ability to develop applications or use platform as a service, and Amazon Web Services was the number one player. Microsoft Azure came behind that, and even folks coming from the telephony side of the house like CenturyLink provided a very strong and rich application development environment for application developers. And what you saw over time is we no longer have underutilized development machines sitting on-prem. Typically, most people buy the development capability they need, platform as a service, from one of these three vendors or more, especially as you go to other countries. So that's platform as a service. I mentioned that just based on the collision of telephony and cloud, and because telephony powers the cloud, we did historically see wireline and wireless carriers get into this space. And what's interesting is that we saw some very traditional telcos like CenturyLink by Savvis, Verizon bought Terramark, Time Warner Cable bought Navisite, but that's now going to market under the name of Spectrum, and folks like Comcast. So what you start to see here is Savvis, Terramark, and Navisite were three of the very original infrastructure as a service providers. They competed with folks like Rackspace and Amazon Web Services in the early days. And as telephony collided and became much more close with IT to make cloud, we saw the telcos and cablecos get into this space and buy that infrastructure as a service capability. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. If we wanted to compare and contrast that, later after that, we started to see players like IBM and VMware, so traditional hardware and software players, also get into the infrastructure as a service space. They joined probably the biggest original, which would have been Amazon Web Services, and then a longtime player like Rackspace. So what's interesting over time is that these two buckets, both the wireline and the infrastructure as a service, they tend to be the same bucket originally, right, because they all came from infrastructure as a service, but they became two buckets when the telcos and cablecos bought the infrastructure as a service capability. And then the last bucket would be everybody else, all the specialty players, all the hosters, all the local players that are local to your country, to your geography, and it doesn't matter whether it's somebody like Ingenix, you know, who might be managing mobility or whether it's somebody like Pete Colo who specialized in managing data centers so that partners didn't have to build their own data centers and built those data centers just for partners to go to market. It really doesn't matter how you look at it. There's a whole bunch of vertical specialty people who might specialize in compliance or Department of Defense or horizontal things like data centers throughout the market. At the end of the day, what's important to know is most of these players are recruiting your partners, whether you're a PBX VAR, whether you're an IT solution provider, whether you're a telephony agent, everybody is looking for people to take their solutions to market. Now, let's look at the bottom line. Bottom line, if you take a look at the 2016, the current magic quadrant for infrastructure as a service, because you can put the infrastructure as a service, the wireline, the platform as a service, you can actually put all those very closely these days, roughly in about the same bucket. They're all moving in the same direction. You'd see two big players. It's Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure. After that, everybody else is moving to get more share. Okay. Now, I mentioned historically this concept of telephony moving into the IT space, and if you look recently at the press, and these are we watch them on a regular basis, but a couple of examples from 2015 and 2016, we started to see the market turn again, and what we saw was some players starting to get out of the data center space, and I could do a whole slide on people who've gotten out. Cisco's gotten out of the infrastructure as a service space, right? HP got out of the infrastructure as a service space. We still see our telcos in there, but you start to see a little bit of talk about, will they really stay in this space? Is it strategic to what they're doing? Or will they, in fact, find another way to build and aggregate solutions and take those to market and ensure that the services stick and let Amazon Web Services and Azure have this space? So watch this space. We always do. It's always an interesting conversation. So we've now talked about the traditional business models, the cloud business models, a little bit of background in cloud in terms of the service provider space, because it's a very rich historical and changing space every 6 months. Now what we'd like to do is talk a little bit about partner profitability. From a profitability perspective, we want to look at these business models and understand what they do to make money. And if you take a look at their ability to sell product, provide project-based services or managed services, there are different gross margins that actually go along with those capabilities. So the very first thing we would do is typically, besides asking a partner how they recognize revenue or basically where their revenue comes from, hardware, software, services, of their services, whether their services are recurring revenue, managed or cloud, whether they're project-based services or other, that helps us know which bucket to put them into from a business model definition. Once we understand that, we also want to know, are they largely providing pre-sale capabilities, selling or transacting capabilities, or post-sale capabilities, okay? Those really tell us what types of gross margins they make, meaning how they make money. The reason we talk about gross margins is that's how partners think. That's how partners gauge investments. When you write a value prop and you talk to partners, they're typically thinking, how long will it take me to achieve return on my investment? And if it's typically 6 to 12 months, and they would love for it to be less than 6 months all the time, traditionally if it's 6 to 12 months, we can have a valid conversation. We find at times when it goes over 12 months, we lose them in the conversation. They find it too difficult to maintain those levels of investment. So what I want to show you from that previous funnel of all of those gross margins, we've broken that funnel out into those three categories, product resale, and would tell you traditionally, resale gross margins run anywhere from 5% if it's a commodity product like toners, keyboards, laptops, and they could run all the way up to 40 points of gross margin if they're working in an enterprise space or they're working small business in a very complex solution like a NetSuite, meaning ERP-type products where they don't have to discount the product. And they have promotional discounts that will run, let's say, for the first couple of years. We've seen many of these complex ERP-type vendors put 40 points or more on products. So that would give you a view of how important it is to understand what products they're involved in and how important it is for you to understand where your product plays, because gross margins really vary from a partner perspective. If we look at project-based services that are sold with a statement of work, right, and they're one-time charge services, They run from staff augmentation, where maybe there's only 21 points of gross margin on services, to business process reengineering or business problem solving, which could be 67 points plus of gross margin. So somebody like an Accenture, they're making some pretty high margins on, you know, telling companies how they should move forward strategically and how that business process integrates into IT. Okay, so again, depending on what kind of services, the gross margins vary widely. And the same is true with managed services. If you're reselling a base level managed service, I mean, especially if you're involved in a true commodity service, let's say straight out of Rackspace, it could be 5 to 10 points. But if you own the asset and you manage it efficiently, it could be 70 points or more. So when you think about your program, the gray box in the middle, what are they doing and what do they need from you in terms of developing the capabilities to improve profitability around their core offerings? If we can think about that every time we talk to partners and every time we build a program for partners, we really do get their attention fairly quickly. So let's take a look at this concept of partners and profitability. And we would tell you first, when a partner, you know, puts a business together, whether they're a line of business at Accenture and they're running, you know, banking and finance for Accenture globally, or whether it's a local $1 million solution provider, they look at who their target audience is, meaning is it an enterprise or SMB? They look at their value prop, meaning what are they offering to the customer to solve what business problem? And then how they're going to operate that business. Is it resell? Are they a DMR? Is it managed services? Is it project-based services? So they answer those questions. Who do they sell to? What are they going to sell? How are they going to deliver that? Once they have decided those things, they start to then look at their P&L. And this is what we would call the financial layer, meaning they would take their revenue, subtract out their cost of goods sold. That equals gross margin. That's that funnel I had on the previous page. And we spend a fair amount of time talking to partners about those things. Revenue minus discounted hardware, software, or the cost of their services equals their gross margins. And then if they subtract out from there, they're selling general and administrative expenses, so everything from buildings to sales commissions, that leaves them with their operating income. Okay? So that's the P&L. And we want to think of P&L because partners think P&L. They think gross margin percents, gross margin dollars. They tend to pay their sales reps on gross margin goals, whether those are percents and dollars, where we as vendors tend to pay our people on revenue rather than gross margin. So there's real differences here. So revenue would be any product, any maintenance, any services they sell. Cost of goods sold would be any product that they bought from you at a discount, plus the cost for them to deliver their services. And if you take the revenue minus the cost of goods sold, maybe you're sitting somewhere between, you know, 10, 15, and 35 points. And then from there, you subtract out the commissions for sales reps and managers, your building, copy machines, and you're left ultimately with operating income. Okay? So that's pretty much the discussion. Now, if you take a look at our CAM training, Channel Account Manager training, we know that sometimes we go out and say, hey, dear partner, would love for you to pick up my new product, and oh, by the way, I will sell it to you at a 20% discount. And we go straight in and sell product with a 20% discount, which basically says they're buying the product at 80%, and that becomes their cost of goods sold, and we really don't have a very good idea of what's happening with the rest of this equation. And in CAM training, what we typically teach is there a way for us to go in and to talk about these different capabilities? Can we say, what can we do to help you increase revenue? What can we do to help you decrease cost of goods sold, increase your gross margins, decrease your selling general administrative expense, which ultimately results in increasing your net income? And right there is where you see our levers. Each one of those are our levers. So let's take a look at how we might, in fact, engage those partners. Rather than going in and talking percentages, the thoughts are we would understand what are they doing in terms of revenue. How are they recognizing revenue, right? So you know what business model they are. What are their growth goals? What's the mix of the hardware, software, and services they want to sell and deliver? Are they delivering those things as a managed service, as consulting services, or are they teaming with somebody else to provide the service? The more we understand that, the more we understand their gross margin goals, how they're paying people, how they're controlling their business expenses, and then ultimately what type of operating income they might have. So that is a little bit about why we spend time talking about profitability, so we know what is important to them, and then we ask the question how we can help them achieve that goal. So you think about things like MDF. MDF is going to bring down, in many cases, their selling, general, and administrative expenses, which drives up their operating income, right? If we had some kind of an extra customer discount program or some kind of a rebate or additional discount up front for deal registration, that would drive down their cost of goods sold, which would increase their gross margins. That's the type of conversation we're looking to have. So with that said, I just want to summarize on a very simple P&L that says you take your sales revenue, subtract out cost of goods sold, there's your gross profit margins, gross margin. Subtract out your sales and marketing, your general and administrative, which is SG&A. So here's where your marketing, commissions, and other things, and that would leave out, that would leave your total operating expense. Total operating expense, right, typically falls under the line. You may have heard it called EBITDA, and from EBITDA, they subtract out depreciation, interest, and taxes. When you think of partners who are trying to leave the environment, you'll often hear that their companies are valued by two or three times EBITDA, right? EBITDA is that income or profit before income taxes. So that becomes a very important measure to, let's say, the owner of the firm, where we spend most of our time on things like gross profits and anything we can do to decrease sales, marketing, and other general expenses. Okay, so as a summary, here's some line items just to say what is in the revenue bucket. Hardware, software sales, technical services, consulting, managed services, warranty, programs, all of that, right? Any incentives or rebates we might offer, any of those things, depending on whether they're pre-sale, they may increase revenue. When you think of talking and understanding a partner, especially if you were in the field, you'd want to understand what's the average transaction that this partner sells, how many transactions are they doing a year, and are they doing them on a fairly regular basis, or are they doing just, you know, a small number of very big deals at the end of the year? And that helps you get a really strong feel for the partner. In terms of decreasing cost of goods sold, here's where you actually get the discount of your hardware and software that's sold, where they pay for their delivery personnel, where they pay for their data center or their NOCs if they're running one. If they're developing intellectual property and applications, it would be all here under cost of goods sold in addition to their training costs. So anytime you give training cost and you decrease or waive the training cost, that improves their cost of goods sold. If we took a look at selling general administrative expense, here's where you get the salaries, the commissions, marketing costs. All of that plays in this space. If you can waive the cost of a demo asset for them, that improves SG&A. We don't get involved typically in financing unless you're a Cisco or an IBM and you had some offerings around financing, but here's how the P&L plays out on financing. And when you put that all together, here again is your P&L, and then you see cost drivers around fixed power, purchasing power, credit costs, some of their fixed costs, some of their variable costs, and we look to say, what can we do to impact these costs as we move forward? Okay, so there we give you back the pie. We have looked at this pie of roughly the traditional business models that are represented in the solution provider community that we all look to recruit from. We've added a couple of additional business models that you'll see moving forward into this pie that are the cloud, specifically the cloud broker, right? We won't necessarily see aggregators because we tend to screen them out because we're really looking at customer facing only. And then we've talked a little bit about how these partners make money. We'll do more curriculum later on what's the differences about how these partners make money based on how they recognize revenue, but for now, just introducing the concept. So before you all get on the plane, just want to remind you, we're looking forward to seeing you at the kickoff. There's a pre-work assignment that Lisa Sabouvet sent to each and every one of you. It's a one-page sheet that has seven questions that come straight from reading through the navigator. So just want to remind you that's your ticket to entry. We look forward to seeing you when you get to the kickoff, and good luck with the navigator completing your pre-work assignment, and safe travels, and look forward to spending some good quality time. Take care.